so that when a Serb sees people with a name like Alija Izetbegović, his SS credentials notwithstanding, and Mohamed Sasir Bey coming to power, he or she understood that this basically constituted, for all practical purposes, a reconstitution of the aristocracy or the elite, the power elite, of the old Ottoman Empire. So again, one should understand the effect that that's going to have. Again, the B.E.G., Izetbegović's name, is a reference to the Beys, as they were called, and Mohamed Sasir Bey's name, B.E.Y., is a direct recapitulation of the Beys. Mohamed Sasir Bey, by the way, was his first foreign minister. He was educated at that bastion of Islamic scholarship, Tulane University in New Orleans. Some of you may have heard of that. It's one of the best-known Islamic institutions in the United States. I'm kidding, of course. There's nothing Islamic about Tulane University, but this, I think, is indicative of some of the nurturing of what was to become the, quote, independent, unquote, leadership of Bosnia by the United States and also Germany. So again, what took place in Bosnia with the ascension of this particular government was a recapitulation of some historical realities, one of them centuries old, going back to the Ottoman Empire, and the other less than half a century old, what took place in the Balkans under Adolf Hitler and company, both of which were not only insulting to, but deeply alarming to the Serbs. Now, when Bosnia declared its independence, a civil war resulted, and that war resulted when the Serbs, who did not want to live in an Islamic fundamentalist state, headed up by a fellow who used to be in the Waffen-SS and who then recreated his old Waffen-SS unit anew in the 1990s, they declared their independence, and by the way, did so under the auspices of international law, the same principles that had been hammered together by the international community to justify the intervention on behalf of the Croatians and Slovenians or the Bosnians, basically made it absolutely legal for the Serbs to declare their independence in Croatia and in Bosnia. They did, and were then branded, I should say, as rebels or as aggressors. Once again, when the civil war took place, when the Serbian units of the Yugoslav National Army attempted to intervene in Bosnia on behalf of Serbs who were facing ethnic cleansing there, they were labeled as aggressors. And there has been a series of one-sided military, economic, and diplomatic actions that have been taken over the years. A no-fly zone was set up in Bosnia, which was selectively enforced. Basically, Islamic aircraft and Croatian aircraft were able to fly with impunity, but any Yugoslavian National Air Force jets that flew in that area were attacked by NATO aircraft. The United States brought its considerable air arm to bear, along with other NATO countries, on behalf not only of the Croatians, but also of the Bosnians. And again, there, once again, a program of ethnic cleansing was instituted. When the Bosnian military proved incapable by itself of defeating the Yugoslavian National Army, the United States stepped in along with Germany, which continued to channel arms to that region. And they basically forged a Croat-Bosnian-Muslim alliance with American financing and training and arms, and they engaged in an offensive in the spring and summer of 1995, and hundreds of thousands of Serbs once again were ethnically cleansed. Over 100,000 Serbs were cleansed from the Krajina region. That's spelled K-R-A-J-I-N-A. And as I mentioned at the very top of the talk, we hear about these are rebel Serbs. Well, those Serbs had lived in the Krajina region for 300 years. They'd been living there for 100 years when the United States became a country. But no sooner does Bosnia become independent or Croatia become, quote, independent, than all of a sudden these people are becoming rebels. What they did was they declared their independence from these newly created countries, countries which were overtly hostile, countries which had engaged in ethnic cleansing in the 1990s, countries which had a history of oppression of the Serbian people going back centuries, in the case of the Muslims, who would again were the heirs to the Ottoman legacy, and 50 years in the case of the Croatians. And again, some of the bloodletting that took place there in the World War II years is not at all irrelevant. It's very, very relevant to what is taking place today. Nonetheless, however, we heard nothing about the ethnic cleansing of the Serbs from these regions or the terribly unequal treatment that the Serbs received. It's worth noting, too, that the United States, to a large extent, allowed the tone of events in the Balkans to be set by Germany and the Vatican. The international journalistic perception of the Serb as a sort of bearded, drunken Chetnik, you know, bespattered with the blood of their victims, goes back largely to the demonization of the Serbs by Germany and the picture that was created by the Vatican, which portrayed Yugoslavia, ironically enough, as the last bastion of Soviet-style Stalinist dictatorship in Europe. This was a concept that got marketed very effectively. It's not only wrong, but it's incredibly ironic in light of the fact that Yugoslavia was the very first of the Eastern European countries to declare its independence from Stalin. Tito broke with Stalin in 1948, and Yugoslavia was training from that point forward to conduct military operations against the Red Army as well as against NATO forces. So it's incredibly ironic and completely incorrect that this stereotype of the Serbs as, you know, Stalinist oppressors and, you know, drunken, bearded, evil Chetniks, you know, bespattered with the blood of their victims. Nothing could be further from the truth, although that is not, again, that's again not to say that they have not committed atrocities. Certainly atrocities have been committed by Serbs. Those things happen in civil wars, and this is not to excuse those, but rather to come to understand those and to understand that as a people, the Serbs are not aggressors, the Serbs are victims. And we're at a fairly useful cadence point at this point. Now, I've been telescoping a lot of history up to this point. We could take a break now, and I could specifically begin talking about Kosovo and the latest resumption of hostilities and some of the other things, or I can keep going. I'll let that be up to you. We've still got plenty of time. How many of you want to take a break at this point? All right, it's break time. So we will do that, and then we'll come back, and we will deal with the latest about some things. The history of the Balkans is complex. There are things that I could have spoken about if for a longer and more detailed accounting of some of the early history of the latest Balkans war. For the record, segment 154 and 157 have some... Is it 157? Yeah, it's 157. Are the sequence readings of a wonderful paper on the Balkans war by T.W. Bill Carr. That's a more detailed presentation than I would have time to do here. By the way, another aside, I've been writing long descriptions for the website, the Spitfire website. The designation FTR refers to For the Record. I realize that the format that I use on the air is very pedantic. I would recommend that people access the website because there are long descriptions of the programs on the website, and I'm rewriting descriptions for the archive shows. Each of the descriptions for the record segments is sort of like a mini article. The difference is that the footnotes are the actual tapes themselves. But the website is www.spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. By the way, make sure you get Spitfire List. There are several. Apparently, there are two different Spitfire organizations. One of which is some sort of marketing outfit. Then there's also a Spitfire organization which is devoted to, you know, enthusiasts of the World War II fighter plane, which was the inspiration for Spitfire, the tape duplication service. That website is www.spitfirelist.com. It's also duplicated, although usually the KFJC website is a little bit behind, on the KFJC website, www.kfjc.org. And I mentioned that because I'm putting a lot of work, or as much as I have time for, into those descriptions. And people have asked me, you know, am I going to write a book or something? No, I do this, but that website is already approaching the length of a book. If it were in conventional pages, it's already over 100 pages, even leaving out the archive show descriptions, and expanding all of the time. So I'd recommend for listeners who are of a more devoted or scholarly bent, do access that website, or if you don't have access to the web, Spitfire will send you that. And maybe get in the habit of combining your tapes or dovetailing your tapes with those descriptions, because it'll give you a good, you know, people like some hard copy or something they can read, which I understand, and that'll give you a good summation of the programs that I'm doing. And so if you want to then go and relay the information to somebody else, and if the admittedly limited, linear and pedantic format that I use on the air is kind of tough for you to deal with, tape the shows and then dovetail that with the descriptions on the website, because I'm working real hard on that, and so's Al and so are the people from KFJC, keeping that up to date. And that's really where the book is the website, and it's available to anybody around the world. I think that's the best way of disseminating the information. So I'd recommend that people get that. And for the, in particular, FTR 154 and 157, I believe it is, or 156, are this T.W. Bill Carr paper, which is a more detailed analysis of some of the things that I'm talking about. Now, Kosovo, we've gone through some of the history of the Balkans, going back to the Ottoman Empire, and one must understand some of that history to understand the present hostilities. We reviewed some of the aspects of World War II with regard to the Balkans and what is going on. We've got Yugoslavia broken up and destabilized and going the way of all flesh. And I would note that Kosovo is, again, a province of Serbia. It has tremendous historical and economic significance for the Serbian people. It was at the Battle of Kosovo Skopje that the Serb nobility and military capabilities were wiped out in 1389. This led to 500 years of Ottoman domination of that region, concluding in the late 19th century. And there also was the history of that region in the Second World War, in which to a certain extent some of those political realities were made manifest again. Now, Kosovo is one of those areas in which both the history of the Balkans going back centuries and specifically the history of World War II in the Balkans, I think, has to be understood to a point to grasp the realities there. Again, Kosovo is primarily ethnic Albanian, as I'm sure everybody knows by now. Those people are Muslims, and they enjoyed a relatively privileged status under the Ottoman Empire. The Serbs were second-class citizens. They couldn't own land. They couldn't ride into town on horseback. Couldn't even wear the color green, which is sacred to the Islamic faith. The ethnic Albanians, like the other Muslim nationalities in the Balkans, enjoyed a relatively privileged status under the Ottoman Empire, and that was for 500 years. And 500 years of oppression is not something that people are going to forget very easily. Now, the realities there once again coalesced in World War II when the Germans, as I mentioned, sought to exploit some of the ethnic divisions and the ethnic and hostilities and some of the old political realities to their advantage. Initially, it was the Italian fascist occupiers of the Balkans who had the idea of uniting Kosovo with Albania to form a greater Albania. Later, the Germans acknowledged this this political division and formally recognized Greater Albania. So in World War II, to a certain extent, the Muslim or Islamic hegemony that had existed under the Ottoman Empire was recreated only under German fascist auspices and Italian fascist auspices. Kosovo was reunited with Albania, and temporarily a Greater Albania held sway in that region. The ethnic Albanians throughout the region, including Kosovo, participated along with the Bosnian Muslim Hanjar and other units in the slaughter of Serbs in World War II. And again, it's worth understanding not only the ferocity of what the Serbs experienced at the hands of the Ustashi and others, but that the various accounts of the actual loss of life differ. One will see estimates of the loss of life ranging from a conservative estimate of 350 to 400,000 Serbs on up to 750,000 Serbs killed. And not just killed, but done to death in the most terrible ways. People here in the Silicon Valley can touch bases with a short, maybe, well, I don't think they'll mind too much, but people think this is something that's long ago and far away. We're going to talk about the recapitulation of some of these political realities. But in the Monta Vista section of Cupertino, right by De Anza College, you'll note where there's the post office on the right-hand side. There's a small falafel place there called Vivi's. I came to know it because it's right near where a radio station KKUP used to be. Vivi's is owned by a couple, or was, I believe they still own it, although there's a Korean family who operate it most of the time. But it's owned by an Israeli couple who are both of Yugoslavian origins. They're a couple of Yugoslavian Jews. And the father of the fellow, who is the male of the couple, his father escaped from Jasenovac during World War II. He was interned in Jasenovac. And what had happened was from time to time the Ustashi would take the inmates out for work details. And at one point he was on a group of inmates from Jasenovac who were out cutting wood, and they were ambushed by Yugoslavian partisans. They heard a cry, Yugoslavs, down! And they just opened fire, and that's how he was freed. They killed all the Ustashi guards. Unfortunately, of the 25 in the work party, he was one of three who survived because they didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, they didn't know this was taking place. It was an ambush, and the partisans called out, Yugoslavs, down! And they were kind of looking around, and by the time the hail of gunfire took place, and most of the inmates had been killed as well. But he was able to escape in that fashion. However, his children were not so fortunate. I was speaking with him about Jasenovac, and there was a children's camp that was separate from the adults. And then there was also a hospital inside. It's where he met his future wife, who was a nurse at that hospital. But they kept the hospital in the middle of the camp so that the Allies wouldn't bomb it. And there was also a children's camp, which was separated by barbed wire from the adult. And he learned that his children had been murdered in that camp when he saw other children wearing his children's clothes, which he knew. They then, you know, before they killed them, they would disrobe them and then take the clothes and use them to clothe other inmates. This, of course, meant that his children, bear in mind that Yasinovac was a converted brickyard, and instead of gassing the victims and cremating them, they herded the victims into the kilns and then fired them up and burned them alive. And the father of the fellow who owns Vivi's experienced that firsthand. He was an inmate at Yasinovac and barely escaped in that ambush. And his children were incinerated alive, and he had to endure that. And I've spoken with a fellow whose name I forget who owns that, and he just said after what his father experienced, he was just a husk. He just, you know, very little joie de vivre or enthusiasm for much of anything. His attitude is just he wants to live and let live, but it kind of scoured him out as a human being. And it's interesting because he was an automobile salesman. He ran an auto dealership in pre-war Yugoslavia. And the people who came to arrest him were all the losers in the town. He'd been very generous, and he took pity on the poor people and would give them food and stuff in times of winter. And the people who were attracted to the fascist movement and the people who ultimately arrested him when he was taken to Yasinovac were all the losers in town, including a lot of the people that he'd helped out. This is an interesting and important thing about fascism, because although it serves the corporate state and the very wealthy and the elite, a lot of the people who get sucked in order to do the dirty work at the operational level are people who are, well, they're in a fairly wretched state. I hesitate to use the term low self-esteem because it doesn't come close to covering what I'm talking about. It's also a little too close to contemporary psychobabble. But basically, they're losers, and they get attracted to this movement because, you know, they're no longer, you know, Joe Blow sitting there, you know, picking their whatever. They're now members of this great movement marching to the horizon, this unstoppable phalanx. And it really appeals to people who are, you know, wretched and not very well off, because it gives them a chance to feel like they're big men. And so it was all the people who came to arrest him were all the little wretched losers and the alcoholics and the scumbags in town, and they all showed up to arrest him to take him down. A lot of them, people he'd helped. And it's something we may see in this country. But anyway, having recapped some of what we've looked at, Kosovo is an area where the long-term history and the history from World War II has manifested itself in a very dramatic fashion. Now, as I mentioned, Kosovo, although primarily ethnic Albanian, was part of Serbia, has tremendous emotional and historical significance to Serbs. It also has tremendous economic significance as well, because the most valuable piece of economic real estate in the Balkans is the Trepka mines. It's a mining complex that produces a lot of different minerals, and the ores there are very rich. There's something like 30%, which is a very, very rich ore, and consequently makes the extraction of the desired mineral from that ore relatively easy. Kosovo had been given autonomy, not independence, but autonomy under Josip Broz Tito, and the ethnic Albanian majority in Kosovo then used that autonomy to begin oppressing the Slavic and Serbian minority in Kosovo, and they were agitating for independence. This obviously was not something that sat well with the Yugoslav government. It did not sit well with the Serbs because of the history that I've mentioned. Again, the Serbs were second-class citizens in the Ottoman Empire. The ethnic Albanians enjoyed a relatively privileged status. And then, of course, the ethnic Albanians lined up with the Axis in World War II and engaged in the slaughter of the Serbs. That and plus the economic factors certainly did not cause the Serbs to view the ethnic Albanian oppression of the Serbian minority with a great deal of tolerance. It's also worth noting, as I mentioned, that ironically enough, I think I can probably take my backpack off, you know. I think it's safe at this point. It's indicative, I suppose, of one's powers of concentration. I could have lectured at the end of the thing. I would never even notice I had the thing on there. But anyway, it's worth noting, though, that when this took place, that here we're being told about Slobodan Milosevic, the new Hitler, and this, that, and the other thing. Nothing could be further from the truth. Not to say the guy isn't what he very much is like one of the old machine bosses in American inner city political machines. He's certainly no flowering Democrat with a small D. On the other hand, he came to power within the Yugoslavian Communist Party because of the reaction on the part of the Serbs to the oppression of the Serbs in Kosovo by the ethnic Albanian majority who'd been granted autonomy. It's very important to remember that because he was essentially a reactionary, is a reactionary, and his rise to power was spurred by the very series of events which erupted in the past several months. It's also worth noting that even though it was not only a communist country, but one of the darkest of the communist countries, Albania under Enver Hoxha, Enver Hoxha was a Stalinist. He also was an Albanian chauvinist, and he actively supported the independence aspirations of the neighboring Kosovars. The situation in Kosovo is also interesting because in 1993, George Bush, Citizen Bush, who at that time was an ex-president, said that basically, he's also an oil man and in all likelihood career employee of the CIA. He noted that there were large petroleum reserves that had been detected in Albania, and he said if there were any hostilities in Kosovo, the troops would go in. Well, he turned out to be a prophet, did old George. There were hostilities in Kosovo, and the troops went in. It's worth noting that there are very substantive indications that not only German intelligence, but American intelligence as well, have actively groomed the KLA and have actively supported a program of covert operations in Kosovo. The initial sponsors of the KLA were the Germans, and that should not come as a great surprise to people, again, bearing in mind the German sponsorship of the ethnic Albanian separatist movement in World War II, which was one of the things that they utilized to maintain control there. It should not come as a great surprise to see that the Germans and the BND were actively supporting the KLA and channeling weapons to the KLA. The Bundeswehr, the German army, has been conducting joint maneuvers with the Albanian army, and there are very firm indications that the German intelligence had actively supported the KLA and was getting weapons to them and training as well. Later, it appears that the burden of covert operations, so to speak, fell to the United States. And what we're looking at in Kosovo is the product, once again, of a joint destabilization program by the United States and Germany. It's also interesting, too, that the KLA is a very interesting creature. The KLA has a number of different ideological founts from which it flows. One of those is Islamic fundamentalist. Another of those is communist, albeit old-line communist. Bear in mind that many of the Kosovars viewed Josip Broz Tito as something of a patriarch and somebody that they greatly revered. But the dominant influence in the KLA are the Albanian fighters, the descendants of the Albanian fighters who had allied themselves with the Axis, and in particular, many of the members of the KLA are sons and grandsons of the members of the Skanderberg Division. Now, the Skanderberg Division, recall, was one of these two Muslim Waffen-SS divisions in the Second World War that I mentioned earlier. I mentioned earlier the Hanjar Division as well. Bear in mind, again, that as I said, that no sooner did Ali Izetbegovic become president of Bosnia than he revived the Hanjar Division, again, explicitly named after and patterned after the 13th Waffen-SS Division in World War II, but that this division, which serves as a kind of a Muslim special forces unit, it backs up other units in combat. It also serves as the palace guard, the Praetorian Guard, for Izetbegovic and his fellow cabinet members. It also is composed primarily of ethnic Albanians, and they are trained in turn by Pakistani and Afghan veterans of the Afghan War, America's largest covert operation of the 1980s. Bear in mind also that in the mid-1990s, the Hanjar Division was engaged in force projection into the Kosovo-Albania-Macedonia area, where they were undoubtedly working with the fighters from the KLA and German intelligence and American intelligence. And I think one, it's a question I posed in For the Record segment 161. In light of the fact that the original Hanjar Division was the 13th Waffen-SS Division from World War II, then it was revived by Ali Izetbegovic, composed primarily of ethnic Albanians, trained by Afghan veterans, and it was engaged in force projection into Kosovo. In light of the fact that many of the members of the KLA are the sons and grandsons of the Skanderberg Division, we could perhaps view the KLA as Skanderberg II or Hanjar Division III. Take your pick in that regard. I can appreciate that some of the things that I may be talking about, not just in this lecture, but on One Step Beyond, might seem really arcane or weird. I mean, you know, come on, babe. You know, what's all the stuff about the Hanjar Division? You know, that's weird, dude. You know, I don't want to know about that. It's worth going into some of these historical and political connections because they are very much at one with what is taking place today. It's also worth noting that the KLA has a very, very strong history of involvement with the drug trade and indeed ethnic Albanians, and this should not be misunderstood as ethnic chauvinism of any kind. Albania is incredibly poor. It was dirt poor under Enver Hoxha, and then when the IMF and the other international financial bodies of the New World Order got a hold of it, they imposed rigorous conditions on Albania that made a very bad situation even worse. And when a number of Ponzi schemes went belly up in the late 1990s, basically, the Albanian armory was looted, and organized crime became essentially the dominant element in Albania. Ethnic Albanians have traditionally had a large participation in the criminal enterprises in the Balkans. They have had much to do with the so-called Balkans heroin route, in which heroin coming from Turkey and Iran and the so-called Golden Crescent of Afghanistan and Pakistan goes through the Balkans, where it is transited to Western Europe and in many cases to the United States as well. The KLA have been heavily involved in the heroin trade. Richard Armitage, by the way, a former Deputy Secretary of Defense and an individual whose name is synonymous with covert operations and the Contra affair in particular, was very active in the Balkans and in the former Soviet Union. And I think it's very interesting that now we find America's military allies, the KLA, to be not only a criminal syndicate, but specifically involved in heroin trafficking. I would also note that here in the United States, there's a new problem. I was watching a thing on TV about this just the other day. What is it? A new epidemic of heroin, very powerful, cheap heroin, and young people are starting to overdose. The new menace on America's streets. Well, surprise, surprise. American covert operations in the 80s had to do with the Contras, so we had tons of coke on the street. Now they're having to do with the KLA, so now we've got junk on the streets, and young people are dying of heroin overdoses. It shouldn't come as that much of a surprise. By the way, one of the people who really deserves your strong support is Frank Viviano, who for years has been doing some of the best writing in the whole world, really, and certainly the best coverage of European matters in the mainstream American media. He did a great series in May, on May 5th and 11th, I believe, acting from memory, two front-page stories about, first, the KLA and the heroin traffic, and they're well-recognized throughout Europe as heroin traffickers, and then, beyond that, talking about the ethnic Albanian organized crime syndicates and how they have taken advantage of the war in Kosovo to basically seize the KLA and Kosovar's rackets from them and are muscling them out. So now the major Albanian clans are muscling out the KLA and the Kosovars on their own syndicates, on their own home turf. Again, this should not be misunderstood as any kind of ethnic chauvinism or engaging in bigotry against Albanians. It's a product of the social circumstances there, and it is dirt poor. And when people are poor, they often turn to crime to survive. They don't just curl up in the gutters and die. That's not the way people behave. So it's to be understood against the background of social conditions and economic conditions in Albania. But organized crime is the main industry in Albania now. And indeed, the organized crime syndicates there are so powerful that basically they pretty much run the government. And if you're going to be in power in Albania, you had better have an element of those syndicates on your side. You're not going anyplace. The relief workers that have been going to Albania after the war started have been accosted by and in many cases ripped off by many of these syndicates. If you don't pay, then basically you lose your trucks. A lot of them have had their vehicles stolen. Kosovar women have been sold into slave prostitution as soon as they crossed into neighboring Macedonia or Albania. It's one of the reasons you don't see a lot of attractive women of childbearing age in these pictures of the refugees of the Kosovars, because no sooner did they get out of Kosovo than they were snatched up by the Albanian mafia and sold into slave prostitution, or white slavery, as it's sometimes called. Automobile theft is reported to be so rampant in that area that one organized crime chieftain in Albania boasted that two-thirds of all of the cars in the country were stolen. An official with the Guardia di Finanza, the Italian Treasury Police, said he viewed that figure as credible and mentioned that the president of the Albanian Central Bank had been arrested in Italy in 1996 because he was driving a stolen Mercedes. When a contingent of Albanian diplomats was passing through Italy, they were stopped by the Guardia di Finanza, who found their paperwork somewhat suspicious. And upon investigation, they found out that these Albanian government officials were four of the top organized crime chieftains in Albania, including the Albanian Capo di Tutti Capo, wanted for murder, among other crimes. And they were traveling on forged diplomatic passports to attend a symposium at the European Parliament in Strasbourg on crime. They were basically going to ratify a treaty on organized crime. This will give you an idea of how corrupt things are there. The point being that the Albanian milieu is one that is inextricably linked with organized crime and drug trafficking. One of the aspects of the Balkans War that did not get the press in this country that it deserved, and it's shocking, is what the actual Rambouillet treatment, the actual Rambouillet Accords said. Those accords were worded in such a way, and this is beginning to come out in some alternative media in this country. The Rambouillet Accords were worded in such a way as it was absolutely impossible for Slobodan Milosevic or any other leader of a sovereign country to go along with it. One of the appendices to Kosovo basically would have permitted NATO to operate with impunity throughout all of Yugoslavia. This is stated in one of the appendices to the Rambouillet Accord. There was no way that they were going to allow NATO forces to run, basically would have permitted virtually an occupation of all of Yugoslavia by NATO. Beyond that, another of the appendices basically gave NATO forces complete legal immunity from any crimes committed while so occupying Yugoslavia. Now imagine if we were presented with a diplomatic paper which would have permitted, oh, again, let's assume that greater Mexico was going to be a threat. There were military power greater than the United States that was seeking to exploit the Latino minority in this country as a vehicle for carving up the United States. Suppose there was an agreement. Suppose once the Mexicans had been granted functional autonomy in Texas and California and Arizona and New Mexico, and suppose that still wasn't good enough. Suppose that this giant military power greater than the United States insisted basically that we allow its forces to occupy, to operate with impunity throughout the United States and basically gave them legal immunity from any crimes that they committed while occupying the United States. Do you think we would agree to that? Not bloody likely. Well, Slobodan Milosevic didn't agree to it either, and it is now starting to come out that some American diplomats were indiscreet, and they basically boasted that we had, quote, set the bar too high, unquote, their exact words, for Milosevic to sign. It's worth understanding that what the West was looking at with regard to Kosovo was not a peaceful solution, but that this was ordained in advance. The military solution was ordained in advance. And I suspect, and this is obviously my own opinion, but I think that among the things that were done in this war was the sending of a message. Because of the heroism of the Yugoslavian partisans in World War II, I think a message was being sent, basically, to anyone who would resist fascism, that basically, yeah, well, World War II is over, and it may have taken us 50 years, but Hitler won. The Axis won, the partisans are now gone, Yugoslavia has been carved up, Soviet Union's been carved up, Germany's reunited, Yugoslavia or Czechoslovakia has been carved up. It's the New World Order, folks, and don't ever think about these Yugoslavian partisans and Serb heroes, because basically we're going to show you what happens when you stand up to fascism. We're going to ruin that country, we're going to destroy them, and we will do it without the loss of a single aircraft or a single pilot. They did shoot down one stealth plane. They may have shot down other aircraft as well, but we weren't told about it. But I think at a symbolic level, I think this was a message to the world community and a message to those who are familiar with the history of that region, because although in the United States, they didn't know anything. You know, Serbs, yeah, I heard about them. I don't know much about them. But in the rest of the world, they do know about the Yugoslavian resistance in World War II, and it had tremendous symbolic importance at the time and in the years since. And I think among the messages that has been sent is basically, forget it. That's over. They lost, and we're going to show you how the reality. It took us 50 years, but we've got our act together now, and now we're going to show you what happens when you resist. For the time being, anyway, Kosovo is a NATO protectorate. Bear in mind, again, that it contains the Trepka mines, the most valuable economic real estate in all the Balkans, provided Nazi Germany with 40% of its lead in World War II. It's going to be interesting to see who winds up with stewardship of the Trepka mines. My money would be on Germany. Because the real winners in this were Germany. I'm going to talk about how Germany behaved in this and also some of the Russian actions in connection with this. But I wondered whether perhaps the British wanted to send in ground troops so they could get a hold of the Trepka mines to keep it from the Germans. Because I would bet that the Germans wind up in control of that just because they seem to be six steps ahead of everybody else in this whole thing. Bear in mind, again, that Germany is responsible for the breakup of Yugoslavia. That's very, very important because this is their show, and they've been bringing everybody else along with them on this one. And I think maybe the single most important aspect of this war, and something that has had very, well, I shouldn't say the most important aspect, but one of the aspects of it that's critical and that looms very large for the future and has not been discussed is the behavior of Germany in this particular regard. Now, first of all, I think that the center-left government in Germany now is a front for the most reactionary elements in that society, and that is the Underground Reich. There was a very interesting signpost for this current, quote, center-left government, unquote, which I believe is nothing more than a front. First of all, the leader of the Green Party in Germany, Petra Kelly, was murdered in 1992. The void in the leadership of the Green Party was filled by none other than Joschka Fischer, who is now the German foreign minister. Joschka Fischer was one of the focal points of the German peace movement in the late 1980s, and it was the apparent strength of that peace movement that convinced Gorbachev that it was okay to permit German reunification. Well, Gorbachev gave his go-ahead. Germany reunified, and surprise, surprise, that peace movement transmogrified into a war movement, and specifically the same elements that had been telling, oh, we can't have World War III, blah, 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 then all of a sudden began demonizing the Serbs, and the guy who led the anti-Serbian Bundestag contingent was none other than Joschka Fischer, the nice touchy-feely former cab driver from God knows where. I don't know what part of Germany he's from. I suspect he's BND, and I think when Petra Kelly got whacked, I think they infiltrated him into that position. It's worth understanding. Oh, by the way, more about this German government. One of the very first things this government did was to have a, reacted and put a lot of importance on some things that took place in the German book trade fair. Now, I've talked in the past about how the two major companies, Bertelsmann and von Holtzbrinck, both connected to the Bormann Organization and the Underground Reich, run American publishing. Well, one of the companies that runs American publishing is the von Holtzbrinck firm. It controls, among other companies, Henry Holton Company. It controls Farrar, Straus and Giroux, St. Martin's Press, and others. And one of the people that the von Holtzbrinck firm appointed to run Henry Holt, in fact, the guy they appointed to run Henry Holt, was a guy named Michael Naumann. He was appointed by von Holtzbrinck, which is a company that was very close to Hitler during World War II. The elder von Holtzbrinck joined the Nazi Party in 1931, 2 years before Hitler came to power. He was noted for employing Nazi Party members in his post-war publishing business, even when that was forbidden and was considered very, very dicey, including one notorious former SS man affiliated with the Goebbels propaganda ministry. Well, the von Holtzbrinck firm appointed Michael Naumann to head up Henry Holt and Company, however, he proved to be too abusive for the American underlings, and he promptly had to go elsewhere. He was appointed culture minister of Germany by this new, quote, center-left government, unquote. And at the awarding by Michael Naumann of the Peace Prize for the German book trade, a fellow named Martin Walzer got up and basically said that now it was a new Germany. We had no connection to the past, you know, and that no one should attempt to connect Germany with its Nazi past. And in characteristically heavy-handed German fashion, sorry, it was not meant to be ethnically biased, but he then said, and he issued a blunt warning that anyone attempting to link Germany with its Nazi past would find that it works against them to do so, unquote. Very typically heavy-handed, although equivocal, German wording. I mean, here basically is this guy at an ostensible center-left government getting the peace prize of the German book trade, and he says, you know, okay, you know, if we have a new Germany, if we are not connected in any way with the past, which is not true, although most Germans were not alive in World War II, the institutions were never denazified. The fact of the matter is that Germany's economic largesse results from the Second World War when they plundered all the rest of Europe. So they are no more, it's no more possible for a German to say they're not connected to the realities of the Third Reich. Not that they're Nazis necessarily, than it would be for someone in the American South in 1890 to say, well, we have no more connection with the days of slavery. In fact, they're very much connected to the days of slavery because the economic and social realities that obtain in that area are directly resultant from those events. So here you have the new touchy-feely center-left German government, and at the new touchy-feely German book trade fair, they award the touchy-feely peace prize for the touchy-feely German book trade to Martin Walzer, who says, okay, it's a new Germany, we have no connection with the past, and you better watch out if you try to connect us with the past, because it won't go well for you, which is very interesting. It's an example of what the Germans call, in my opinion, it's an example of what the Germans call Kulturkampf, or culture war, or culture struggle. Gerhard Schroeder, rather, for all of his ostensible cosmopolitan sensibilities, campaigned on a virulent anti-immigrant campaign when he was running for chancellor, and he was scapegoating various ethnic groups in Germany for all of Germany's problems. When you see some of the quotes from Gerhard Schroeder, he sounds like nobody so much as Pat Buchanan in this country. Very, very chauvinistic, bigoted individual. I would also note that right about the same time that Martin Walser was announcing to the rest of the world, oh, there's no more connection between old Germany and the new Germany. We have no connections with the past, and you better not try to connect us with it. You know, a blunt warning after this rumination on the new Germany. Joschka Fischer, again, the same Joschka Fischer who moved into the power vacuum left by the murder of Petra Kelly, the same Joschka Fischer who was initially the focal point of the German peace movement, which then metamorphosed after reunification into the German war movement and the demonization of the Serbs. Joschka Fischer is now proposed early this year, in February of this year, that the EU change the way it determines its vote on issues. It used to be that any major country had the power of veto. That's how Germany affected the breakup of Yugoslavia, because initially, as I mentioned, the EU voted 11-1 to maintain the integrity of the Yugoslav Federation. The one was Germany, who basically said, we're not going along with it, you know, and they're the largest and most politically and economically powerful nation in Europe. Said basically, we're not going along with it until you do what we want.